This is Women Who Lead on 760 WJR with Ann Thomas and Luann Thomas-Ewald. Sponsored by the University of Michigan Health Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital. Now bringing you the women who are making Michigan the best in the nation, Ann Thomas.
On this edition of Women Who Lead, we'll kick off the show with my co-host, Luann Thomas-Ewald. She's the Chief Operating Officer of Michigan Medicine's Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital and C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. You'll also meet a podcaster making a difference in the lives of women. And if you've ever been haunted by a dream, you are not going to want to miss my interview with Terry Racey. She's an author, and she's written a fascinating new book. An interesting and informative show coming up right after these messages. Welcome to Women Who Lead. I'm Ann Thomas, and I have great news today. We have learned that the University of Michigan Health, the Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital, is the new sponsor for Women Who Lead. And on the line with me now is Luann Thomas-Ewald. She is the Chief Operating Officer of the Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital, but she's also my good friend and co-host for Women Who Lead. Lou, this is great news.
This is great news, Ann. You and I have been doing this for a long time. And so it just made sense that Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital become the sponsor of the show. So I'm really excited. And I'm blending my two worlds. It's amazing.
So tell us about some of the great things that happen at the Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, so, you know, we are just so thrilled. Our teams do everything from deliver babies to women's care and gynecological care. And, you know, when Von Voigtlander was built almost 12 years ago, it was built for a prediction of around delivering 4,000 babies. And this year alone, we're going to be delivering about 5,600 babies to enter the state of Michigan. And so we're just so excited. So we're, you know, talking about growth plans so we can continue to meet the demands. And It's so amazing because the birth rate is declining in every other area of the country, but not in Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital. So there's something in the water in Southeast Michigan, and we're happy about that.
Well, and I have a feeling, Lou, that people choose this hospital because of the great care.
Oh, our physicians, our nurses, are top notch. Our programs, our women's programs, continually rank nationally as one of the best. And, you know, there's also things like, you know, really just focusing on the patients and the families and what they need during this time. And, you know, so things like we have a dedicated music therapist for Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital. Mm. So, you know, just really to calm moms or to calm women when they're going through a procedure or whatever they may need throughout the stages of life. Just, you know, we know that the emotional piece is just as important as the medical piece. So just making sure that we're providing the best patient experience possible.
And, you know, despite the fact that it's 2024, women are still dealing with challenges with regard to childbearing. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you're seeing?
Yes. I mean, we're seeing more and more requests for in vitro fertilization. We're seeing, you know, more women having babies later in life. And, you know, really those kinds of services, we're just, you know, we're so happy to provide, but we're seeing the numbers grow. You know, we're also seeing, and, you know, this is almost a national conversation about the lack of research and studies and focus around women in menopause. So, you know, I think, you know, we're really trying to get our arms around, you know, what is best practice? How can we help women, you know, starting from childbearing age all the way through, you know, their more experienced years, and really making sure that University of Michigan is the place to go for all of those things. So we look across the entire spectrum of women's care, women's cancer care, and, you know, our teams are just so dedicated to this population.
And, you know, another area that I have a feeling that you focus on is maternal health and women who are pregnant, and the fact that some women, even now in 2024, are still struggling, and some of the death rates are kind of scary. And so, am I right about this?
It's very scary. Yes, it's very scary. And, you know, and we look at health inequity around that topic too, because we know that more African American mothers die during childbirth. And why is that? And, you know, some of it is access to prenatal care. And so what can we do as University of Michigan to get the word out, to increase the access, to make sure women are getting the prenatal care that they deserve for their health and the health of their baby? So there's a lot of national research being conducted and a lot of talk about this at the national level that we're so happy to be a part of, you know, to really help with these health disparities.
Luann Thomas-Ewald, Chief Operating Officer for the Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital there at the University of Michigan Health System. I am really looking forward to talking about all of these issues with you and meeting all kinds of women who lead candidates for the rest of this year. This is going to be so much fun. I can't wait till you're in the studio and co-hosting with me.
Thanks, Anne. I'm excited.
You are listening to Women Who Lead. We'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Women Who Lead on WJR, sponsored by the University of Michigan Health Von Voigtlander Women's Hospital. Once again, Ann Thomas.
You are listening to Women Who Lead, and I want you to meet Kate Bryan Milligan. Kate is the founder of One Girl Revolution, a nonprofit organization dedicated to highlighting the stories of everyday women and girls who are changing the world through their lives. Kate, welcome to Women Who Lead.
Ann, thank you so much for having me.
Tell our listeners about One Girl Revolution. What is it about and how did it get started?
Yeah, as you mentioned, One Girl Revolution is a nonprofit multimedia enterprise that is dedicated to highlighting the stories of world-changing women and girls across the country, across America. And I founded it because my background's in PR and media, and after lived in Washington, D.C. for multiple years, I now live in the city of Detroit. But living and working in Washington, D.C., I started realizing that women's voices and their stories weren't being told in the media. And when they were, it was often politicized or divisive. And I really wanted to create a space for women and girls who are doing incredible things, changing the world every single day, making history every single day, that they would be able to share their own stories in hopes that we can inspire people, not just women and girls, but people around the world to be the change that they want to see in the world.
Tell us about some of the inspiring people that you have met through this nonprofit.
There are so many, Anne. We have over 200 episodes of our podcast because we utilize different mediums, right? Different media outlets to highlight these stories. So we have the One Girl Revolution podcast, and then we have two Emmy-nominated documentaries on YouTube. And so we utilize visual media, but then also the podcast. And through this whole journey, I've met so many incredible women and girls, everything from 5-year-old little Lily that makes coloring books for children in hospitals, mm-hmm. or 16-year-old Ruby Kate Chitsey, who runs a nonprofit in Harrison, Arkansas, called Three Wishes for Ruby's Residence. And she grants wishes to elderly people in senior living facilities and is encouraging kids and people around the world to do the same, to reach out to this population of elderly people that are so often forgotten about in our culture and in our world. Or Jenny DePaul, who is a stay-at-home mom and lives in New Jersey, and every night she puts her kids to bed and goes out to the streets of New York City to serve those experiencing homelessness. And then there's Miss Catherine, who is based in New Mexico, and she's a retiree, and she started recognizing the lack of resources for African-American mothers, and she created an organization called Sister Friends, where they build community around new mothers and their babies to lower the infant and maternal mortality rates. It's absolutely incredible. And every single story that I've come in contact with, every single woman or girl that I've interviewed has led to another story, and it just continues to grow and evolve. And I can't wait to see where we go from here.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from all of these different interviews, from people that have listened and have been touched by these incredible stories?
Every single person that listens to it, or everyone who comes in contact with One Girl Revolution, they talk about how their eyes are opened, right? Like, and that's the whole mission for me, is I want us to not only see these stories and be inspired by them, but I hope that our eyes are opened and we see opportunities for each and every one of us to be the change that we want to see in the world. And, you know, our motto is every woman has a voice, every woman has a story, every woman has the power to change the world through her life. Every woman is a One Girl Revolution. But my hope is that every single person sees this and says, you know what, I might not have money, but I can do something in my own community. I can donate my time or my talent, right? You're a graphic designer and you can make a difference in the world. And so every person that's listened to the podcast or come in contact with our documentaries or anything that we're doing online, they just talk about how their eyes are opened to things that they didn't know in the world, or and individuals that are making a difference that they didn't even know existed, or problems in our world that they didn't even know existed. And they want to do something to be the change that they want to see in the world, which is amazing.
It's so interesting, Kate Ryan Milligan, that you decided to start something like this. Are there people in your life that have touched you, that kind of inspired you to do this, to want to make a difference and encourage change in the world?
So many people. And I always ask this question on our podcast, you know, who is a One Girl Revolution in your life? Because I'm always interested in not just the story, not just the woman or the girl that we're highlighting, but also we know from our own lives that it really takes a community. You know, it takes a community, a family, to raise up these stories and raise up these individuals. And so my own story, I mean, I think about my great grandmother and being a little girl and hearing her stories and just being so blown away by all the things that she accomplished. And it was a different time than it is today, but just being a little girl and just soaking up those stories and wanting to make a difference in the world in so many different ways. And then, you know, I think about my grandparents, but my own mom, Mary Cullen Bryan, she was a One Girl Revolution to me. She's the OG, as the kids say, the original. And she was a woman before her time, and she did so many incredible things in the world and left such a mark on our world. And she really inspired me and told me from a very young age that I could do anything that I wanted, that I could accomplish anything that I wanted. And she always supported me even in my crazy adventures of, you know, founding something like this. Some people thought I was crazy to just start something like this from scratch, but she knew that it was possible. And I see every single day that it's possible, and it continues to grow and evolve. And so, yeah, I would say that my mom really inspired me and inspired One Girl Revolution.
What are some of the themes that come up over and over again for you when you're doing these interviews?
There are so many different themes. Obviously, like, survivor is a word that comes to mind, and it doesn't just necessarily mean somebody who survived an assault or an attack or abuse. There definitely are those stories, but women are so resilient, and I hear these stories of women who have been through hell and back. And, you know, sitting in the city of Detroit right now, I think about Detroit's motto that there is always hope and it will rise from the ashes. And I see that in each and every one of the women and girls that we interview, that there is this resilience, that there's this survivorship. But we cover everything from homelessness to assault, like I mentioned, abuse. There are definitely those stories, but women who have come through hell and back and are helping other people. And, you know, I talked about the elderly communities, forgotten about populations. We've done a lot on incarceration. Women and girls are the fastest growing population in jail and prison, and we don't often hear about that in the world. And so we've done a lot. We have a documentary called The Girl Inside on YouTube, which we kind of delve into that topic, who these people are, who these women are. And then we've done a whole documentary or a whole podcast series on incarceration in women. And so there are so many different topics that we highlight, but there's this connecting thread to me. There's a connection between each and every one of the stories. Of course, women and girls, you know, being a woman connects us in this sisterhood, which is really beautiful. But I would say, you know, women who have risen from the ashes and survivors who have survived so many different things, hardships in their life, and it looks different for every single person. And I think that we all have those stories. Sometimes life can be great and beautiful, but it also can be difficult and hard, and we experience so many difficult things in life. You know, even loss is one of those things, but that we can rise above it and help other people.
Well, and it has to be so encouraging for people to listen to these podcasts and see how people have risen out of terrible trauma and tragedy and been able to survive and feel good again.
Yes. Well, and it's that whole dichotomy between, you know, being the victim or the victor, right? I believe that we have choices, and every single day we choose how we want to live our life. And some things we can't control, of course. Sometimes we can't control something that happens to us, but we do have the power to choose how we live our lives and how we react to the things that come on our path. And so it is so inspiring to people when they listen to these stories. I'm inspired by every single person that I've talked to, and they have helped me to see different aspects of my life or different things that I've experienced in a new way, which is kind of the unexpected thing for me. I never, I guess, imagined that these stories and that One Girl Revolution would impact my life every single day in the way that it has. I know that it's also not only impacting my life, but every person that comes in contact with it, that it's impacting theirs and helping them to see the power that they have to change the world and change their lives.
Kate Bryan Milligan, founder of One Girl Revolution, thank you for chatting with us today. What a great thing you are doing.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate your love and support of One Girl Revolution.
Absolutely. You are listening to Women Who Lead. We'll be back right after these messages. You are listening to Women Who Lead. I'm Ann Thomas, and I'm here now with Terry Racy. She's the author of a new book called Loving Ourselves Mindfully, 6 Steps to Calming the Inner Critic. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I want you to just start out, Terry, and talk to our listeners a little bit about you and your career and how you came to writing this book.
Well, that's a 50-year story. But I started out by chance entering the first PA program in Michigan. Uh-huh. And I was lucky enough to get a job immediately at Henry Ford Health System in orthopedics. And so my career is in both surgery and orthopedic and plastic surgery and medicine. So during that time, seeing people suffering and working 14 plus hours myself,
wow.
You know, I was seeing stress embodied in others, and I was experiencing it also myself.
Sure. Right.
So I needed to learn techniques, not just for myself, because I was burned out, and I had all kinds of physical symptoms that I was kind of ignoring, like most people do. And eventually it knocked on my door so loudly, and I share that in the book, that I had no choice but to do something about it.
So what did you do? What did you do about it?
So I went looking for, you know, the traditional, basically I was given a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis.
Oh.
And I said, I've got to back up off of this stress. I can't be working 14 hours a day and eating poorly and not exercising and doing all the things that I was suggesting to my patients.
So you went into a different branch of medicine. Talk a little bit about that journey.
Well, that took me a long time. When I started doing, when I was in internal medicine, I started teaching my patients how to relax by using breathing techniques. I call them breathing techniques because to say meditation was to get kicked out of my work as a PA. So that was a frightening word for too many people. It was a bridge too far. So I said breathing technique. And at the time, I had two rooms available to me, so I would bluebird in between one room and the other, talking to and getting the history and doing the physical on the initial person, and then saying, let's try this breathing technique to help you manage your stress more successfully and really nourish your body more successfully, too. So I would give them the instruction, then go see the other patient, then come back after they had practiced it for about 20 minutes. And to a person, they said, I can't believe how relaxed I feel.
That's amazing.
It is quite ordinary when you study the science. It's there in black and white. And breathing is such, what? You're going to get all that from just breathing? Yes.
Yeah, that's really incredible.
We don't know how to breathe. And when we're under stress, we have a tendency to do a short, shallow breath that does not allow us.
Or even hold our breath.
Exactly. And don't even realize we're doing it. Because it's a stress reaction that our body has.
So I want to talk about how you got to writing this book, Loving Ourselves Mindfully, 6 Steps to Calming the Inner Critic. You are the author of other books. Can you talk a little bit about those books? Because I believe those books led to this book.
Yes, they did inform this book. I started out basically trying to work through, using meditation and journaling, trying to work through my frightening storm dreams. And ever since I was a baby, I had these, for as early as I can remember, I had these frightening storm dreams.
Wow.
And, you know, my mom and dad and my sister calmed me down when I awoke in a fright, but they continued. And it wasn't until I started dealing with my own health crisis and the, you know, trying to reduce the stress, that I realized that they were supportive and informative. They actually sent me a message.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so in my doing the meditation and asking why questions and doing the journaling, and my journaling was both in writing and in sketching. The sketching was really important because it helped to unlock a lot of subconscious memories. So as I did all that, part of that process was writing a poem called The Master of the Storm. So the Master of the Storm poem was based on those storm dreams. And in my journaling, I was able to delineate 6 distinct steps. So I put each stanza was one of those steps. And I gave those to my meditation students as an opportunity for them to work through a challenge, because that's what the poem was about. It was about saying, you're safe, you're protected, you're guided, you can do this. Here comes a storm and various stages of the storm to cloudless sunshine at the end of the storm. Those were the 6 steps. Those are the 6 steps.
Before we get into the 6 steps, I want to go through each step with you, Terry Racy. But let's talk first, if you're willing, a little bit about these dreams. Can you describe a dream for us? What was it like?
Oh, it was so scary.
Really?
Especially as a little kid. When I got older and the dream was back again, it was, okay, now you're here again. What does this mean? But as a little kid, it was, you know, dark clouds in the distance, and then there was a tornado, and the tornado would get closer and closer and closer. And in some of the dreams, I would be looking at the tornado and examining it and holding on to the porch post. In others, I'd be calling people to come and take cover. In others, I'd be cowering in the basement. It depended. And what I found out later, what it depended on, was what was the nature of the events in my life at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The more fearsome the events, the more devastating the events, the more fearsome the storm. And the more I cowered in that fear in the context of my dreams.
Oh, that's so interesting. Now, with regard to these dreams, did they happen all the time or just when there was a crisis or an unfortunate event in your life?
No, they did happen exactly as you say, during frightening events, destabilizing events in my life. But I didn't know that.
Right, right.
Until I was an adult and I started really reflecting on them and matching them up with events that were going on at the time I was having a particular dream. And then it all made sense to me. I still do have those dreams, by the way. But it really isn't the entire dream anymore. It's usually I dream there's a storm in the distance, and I see that as a heads up. Something's coming. Get prepared.
Let's get into these six steps. So the name of the book is Loving Ourselves Mindfully, Six Steps to Calming the Inner Critic. Let's just start with step number one.
Step number one. Well, you know, in life, whenever you have a challenge, the first step is always to become aware, to see, hey, what do we got here? In medicine, we'd walk into an ER to see an ER patient. We'd go, okay, what do we got here? And then we'd get a review of, you know, from the people that were currently caring for the patient, what's going on. So the first step is just kind of taking a look, doing a little appraisal of the situation that is before us that is uncomfortable or maybe completely destabilizing.
So that's kind of being mindful, right? Realizing
yes.
that something's going on?
Exactly. And, you know, the second part of the book, the second section of the book is about cultivating mindfulness right here with the first step. There are exercises that are specific to each of the steps that are in the book. So when you're at this first step, you're cultivating mindfulness and you're developing your skills as what I call a scientist of self. You are self-observing. You are observing your environment, the cause and the effect of what's happening there on you personally. How are you reacting to that? You know, and you will be getting skills to respond instead of react from a calm, balanced place. So
let's go to number two.
So number two suggests that we observe and understand. And that basically means use those tools, those mindful tools, to look more deeply at the challenge you're facing. Maybe look into how long this has been going on. What was the first time you had this experience, if it has a long tail? And then looking at those experiences. So expanding your observation skills in both breadth and depth.
And then number three and four.
So step three invites us to own and choose. If we don't own our challenge, we don't have the authority to deal effectively with it, to release it. We must say, yeah, I have a lot of emotions about that, but this is mine to do. This is my stuff, and I will deal with it.
So did you address this issue because you found throughout your career and throughout your lifetime that a lot of people would rather not own a problem, that they would like to just kind of shove it under the rug?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head there, Anne, because this is, you know, what I saw in my work as a physician assistant is that people were stuck at this place. They keep doing the same thing that doesn't work and getting the same results, and they don't get it. Because whatever it is that they're doing repetitively is either too compelling or too painful for them to reckon with. So that step three is really very, very vital to ending the storm.
And I imagine if you don't address step three, you're not going to get to four, five, and six.
Correct.
And what is four?
So four is embrace the full chaos. Mm. Whatever it is that you're being challenged by, you have the tools of mindfulness, you're practicing them. They are going to help buffer your experience. Maybe you've made connections with various support systems and family, friends, therapists, you know, reading, support groups, all kinds of things to help prepare you for the full chaos. if you get into the deepest part of the storm and you allow yourself to use those anchoring tools, you can understand it at the deepest level. And that means that you can, at the deepest level, customize a solution that only you can customize.
And is that what steps 5 and 6 are about, is customizing a solution and kind of coming out of the storm and having some peace?
Yes. Step 5 calls us to celebrate our commitment to change. It's time to take a little break and say, you got this, girl. You got this, boy. You know, and really give yourself some applause here. You've worked hard. This is scary stuff. It's not for wimps.
Can you do it yourself?
Yes, you can. But why would you want to, when there's so much wonderful support available to you, if you will but ask for it, if you will just look for it?
And what's the final step?
Well, the final step is about, it invites you to walk your path as an illumined heart. Your heart is lighter. You feel more joyful because you have let go of a tremendous burden. And now you have an opportunity to share what you know with others. And that's what this book is, basically. It's me sharing what I know with others because I've been there. I've faced those challenges. I've used these tools. There are tons of stories in this book about people that have done that too and triumphed. So this step is putting your triumph into material reality, and however that looks to you as an individual.
The book, again, is Loving Ourselves Mindfully, 6 Steps to Calming the Inner Critic. Do we all have an inner critic?
Absolutely.
And are some of our critics stronger than others, or do some people acknowledge the critic better or more than others? I don't want to always say better, but, you know, some people are really aware of how they're feeling. Other people have a tendency to maybe try to ignore it. So talk a little bit about this inner critic and how people deal with the inner critic.
Well, we do have to discern in our world, don't we?
Right.
And there isn't a single person on the planet that doesn't judge their situation, really.
And judge themselves.
And judge themselves. And judge other people. And make comparisons. They have this, I don't have this, they're doing this, I'm not doing it. It's exploded on the internet, right?
Yes.
Everybody's judging everybody else. And so in the wee hours of the night, our little inner critic comes knocking.
Yes.
And keeps us awake, and we think about the haves and the have-nots in terms of our personal experience, and we start talking to ourselves about how we're useless, and we bring up, you know, descriptors that our parents or our teachers or our spiritual leaders have said about us, and we keep repeating that critic. Everybody's got a critic. When I was writing this book, I certainly knew I had a critic, but I was really kind of shocked as I went through this process over 7 years, working with patients, asking them about it, working with my meditation students, asking them about that, and seeing that, yes, everybody has it. This is not a double-blind controlled study, but it certainly is, in my opinion, reason to indicate that everybody has a critic. But that critical voice is so innate. It is a habit, of a way of talking to ourselves that started when we were able to put together words, and before that, and perhaps thoughts, that we all have a manager, an inner manager. And, you know, I call them the inner critic and the inner sage. And the inner sage's voice is quite different from the critic.
And so this book is about learning how to control your inner critic to have a healthy, happy life.
Yeah, to comment, you know, the inner critic is not all bad.
Right.
I mean, it offers us advice, but most of us take it as, you know, the CEO, and listen in a way that is so indistinct, they don't even know they're listening to a critical voice, and they have other navigational tools they can use.
Final question for you. In 2024, we are seeing an incredible increase in mental health issues for adolescents, young adults, even children. It would seem to me that this book would be a great guide for parents to help children from an early age kind of develop a better mindset about life.
Absolutely. We need to be speaking with more love and compassion every time we speak, whether it is our internal dialogue or our external dialogue. We need to be making sure that we cultivate, and I talk about this in my book, cultivate the language of love. What does that look like? How does that feel as compared to the inner critic's language? So we get to create a new language, and this book will show you how, and that can translate to parents. You know, I used it with my students and with my patients to try and get, well, let's give ourselves a little bit of love. Self-love is self-care.
Because parents may not even realize it, but as they're raising their children and the kids are in all kinds of different activities, they may be asking questions of the children with regard to their academics or their activities, that they're trying to be helpful, but maybe the child is feeling like they're being criticized, and it'll make them more anxious.
Yes, that's really an important point. And so the parent, in a mindful family, Everybody's paying attention, because we all bring our baggage. There's not a single parent that's perfect, or child. You know, we bring our history with us. And being mindful is what helps us walk back things that are hurtful, and so that they don't become a habit in the child's inner dialogue.
Absolutely. Terry Racey, author of the book, Loving Ourselves Mindfully, 6 Steps to Calming the Inner Critic. Thank you for your time today. Thanks for coming into the studio. It was great to see you.
You too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time and attention to this important book.
And where can we get the book, Terry?
Well, right now it's on Amazon.
So just go to Amazon and the book will be at your doorstep in a couple of days.
Yes, and I also have a special meditation that's available on my website, TerriRacey.com.
Wonderful. And you've been listening to Women Who Lead. I'm Ann Thomas, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.